growth became much more moderate, if we changed our fuel mix, then we might have a, you know, not business as usual, and emissions could come down.
There's a lot of optimism built into those IPCC predictions, but what did they say? If we just go on as business as usual and population does expand and all those things you've talked about, what were they expecting to happen by 2100 as far as temperature or sea level rise, do you know?
Well, that's the scenario that's commonly referred to as A1FI. That's the shorthand for the family that it's in is A1, and it's fuel-intensive. If we just keep going, we're in a fuel-intensive mode right now. We're using lots of fuel and all the different kinds of fossil fuels. And if we kept going, so let's assume that population growth, here are the basic assumptions under that. And this was the furthest out that, you know, they said, okay, we need to set a boundary, you know, a goalpost way out there that sort of defines the edge of what we think is possible. And that's if the population growth was medium, but world GDP, gross domestic product, was high, and energy use was high, and land use changes are high, and the availability of oil and gas is high, and technology change is rapid, and our fuel mix is primarily oil and gas. There's still a little coal in there, but it's mostly oil and gas. So those assumptions get us to what was referred to as A1FI, the fuel-intensive scenario. And the emissions, if you look at it and you chart the emissions from that, it's the worst case. It's the largest output of emissions that people thought would be possible. And this was only 6 years ago they were thinking. You know, they kind of laid this out and said, okay, we're not there, we're not going there, but that's the worst case. It's kind of over in the corner.
And so they were looking at what, 3-4 degrees maybe if we went that direction?
If you run, okay, so the models, and I use particularly the Hadley models, if you take the models and run them out, so you run the atmospheric models, the general circulation models out, it takes us pretty close to 6 degrees average global increase in temperature.
Oh, my. Well, that's, you know, barely survivable from the scientists that I've talked to. But your paper suggests we may be already heading beyond this worst-case scenario. So is there a beyond?
No. There isn't, and there sort of is. In the recent IPCC report, the fifth assessment report, which they're still working on, but the Working Group 1 has issued their report, and they use a different kind of framework that's a little bit important, and some of it's just technical stuff. But the equivalent would be what they call the representative concentration pathway, 8.5, the most extreme. And it parallels the A1FI scenario. So for all intents and purposes, they're pretty much the same. The point, though, is that if we look at emissions, then projected emissions along those scenarios, our emissions for the last 10 years have exceeded those modeled projected scenarios. So we are beyond. In terms of emissions, we are beyond that worst-case scenario. And no, we haven't charted one beyond that. We just simply know we're on the outside of that boundary there. Now, one small caveat was that they did dip in 2009 because of the recession. In 2010, they shot back up twofold. It's a minor point, but some people say, aha, but they didn't. So I just want to say that's a small caveat. But overall, over the last 10 years, we have exceeded the emissions that were defined as the worst-case scenario.
So we're into carbon overshoot, but how much more carbon can we put into the atmosphere before we go beyond the alleged 2-degree safe limit?
Well, if we look at it overall in terms of our modern civilization since the Industrial Revolution, we could generally pump about 500 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere before we completely destroy the biosphere as we know it. It's not that it goes away completely and becomes lifeless, but it becomes an entirely different kind of thing with a lot of uncertainty as to whether it wouldn't be a very nice place for human beings. 500 tons. So to date, from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we've already pumped in 370 billion tons. That leaves us 130 billion tons before we reach that limit, okay? And at that point, we're talking about not just 2 degrees, but, you know, more like this 6-degree or better scenario. Alex, the thing is that's really crucial here is, so if we think about even 4 degrees or 6 degrees, I mean, when you're in that range, you're almost in the so what, it doesn't matter anymore category. You're talking pretty catastrophic for future generations. You know, it's just absolutely staggering. If you look at the models and you run them out, it's just pretty darn hard to believe, because once we really get above 4 degrees, you know, some 4 degree projection, all bets are off because of feedbacks, because of Earth system feedbacks, like the methane coming off of the tundra or disruption of ocean circulation. And once those things really kick in, and they have started up, these feedback systems, we've set them off and they are underway, and that's an uncontrolled experiment, and we really are uncertain. We're discovering every single day new information about these feedbacks that are blowing our minds. And I look, last Friday, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the U.S. just put out a paper that evaluated, and this is hot off the press, looking at the amount of change in the reflectivity of the Arctic Ocean in terms of the reducing sea ice. And so we all know about the Arctic sea ice and all that stuff and whatnot. The shocking thing here was that this study quantified very well that the effect of the shrinking sea ice to date, the thermal effect in terms of global warming, is equal to 25% of all the CO2 we've put into the atmosphere in the last 30 years. This is no small potatoes. And we're finding this stuff out every day. The thing about feedbacks is, like I said, this is an uncontrolled experiment, and most of our observations exceed the models.
So just looking at a little math here, you're talking about 500 billion tons maximum, and that even that is probably catastrophic. I believe that you said we were going through about 10 billion tons a year. That looks like 13 to 15 years. We'll have used up all the fossil fuels that we can, and then that's it. The party's over. Am I wrong?
At that point, we're in a catastrophic situation. I'm sorry to say that.
That's really, really close we're talking about. That's not 2100. That's a dozen years or more. And as you say, the Arctic sea ice is already in a record meltback. I did cover that new study last week on Radio EcoShock. It's terribly important. 25% of the global warming could come from that alone, the reflectivity of the sea ice. The weather's become extreme all over the world. Species are going extinct. So it sounds to me like we're already beyond the safety line. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we are. We are beyond the worst-case scenario right now. Now, can we pull it back? It's going to be really hard, and that window is closing on us real fast. The steps that we now have to take are so much greater than they would have been if we had begun scaling back our emissions 5 years ago or 10 years ago. If we had seriously taken it on, we would be in a massively different situation. Can we do it? Well, you know, this is going to be really difficult. We are talking about having to start reducing emissions by 6% now, this year. Okay, and if we do that, and if we were to work really hard on sequestering carbon with things like reforestation and agricultural practices, so taking carbon out of the air and putting it in the soil, by the year 2300, it's possible, it's conceivable that we could stabilize at 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Is this going to be hard? Well, yes. This is a very tall order at this point. It's conceivable. And so what I'm saying is it's not over.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I have a life to live. I have a grandson who has a life to live. So we're going to have to try however hard it is. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dr. Michael Jennings from the University of Idaho. He published a peer-reviewed paper last year on our trajectory towards a worst-case climate change scenario. Michael, I'd like to move into another aspect here. I've recently interviewed experts on the possible economic impacts if we can't burn the reserves that big energy companies count on their books and in their stock promotion. If there isn't a new accounting, we risk a severe economic crash, the experts tell us, when those limits on burnable reserves do become a reality. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is really where the rubber meets the road. Well, right now, Alex, the total amount of gas, oil, and coal, a fossil fuel that's currently owned by somebody, okay, it's accounted for, it's on the books, it's held in reserve. If we were to burn all of that, it would be 2,795 billion tons of carbon. That's 20 times the 130 billion tons that we could still burn and be maybe more or less safe. That represents more than $20 trillion worth of investments. If you own some of that, right, why would you possibly own it? Only so you could sell it and make a profit, okay? The global economic models, the financial expectations of today, are predicated entirely or largely on not just the value of those existing reserves of coal, oil, gas as they're traded and whatnot around the world, but the economic yield of those in energy and goods that are derived from them. So the expectation, and this is not a light expectation, this is a predication, is that we will burn more than 20 times the safe limit. So your question is, if we were to pull back, that would have severe economic consequences. No question it would, but pick your poison.
Well, do we want to survive or do we want to make money? That seems to me what it comes down to, and the two are definitely intertwined. It's not easy. I'm not saying this is easy. And it's not just the big oil and gas companies that people may be picturing. I mean, we have dozens of national economies dependent on fossil fuel revenues, the U.S., Canada, Norway, Australia, Venezuela, a slew of countries in the Middle East. If they can't burn those resources, and many of them are experiencing population booms at the same time, what happens to those countries and geopolitics in general when climate change becomes so real to people that they demand change?
Well, there's no question that we're in for some instabilities. Okay, I would hazard a guess, and this is, you know, my business is on the science side of things, and particularly how biota, plants and animals, respond to climate. But moving forward into this, my speculation is that those responses are going to be very different among different cultures and different people, and the extent to which they have alternatives or don't have alternatives. No question, though, that in many parts of the world there are going to be great instabilities and really some pretty significant sacrifices that people are going to end up having to make. You know, this means us, too. This isn't just some Bangladesh thing here. This includes all of us. But I think that how it rolls out in a geopolitical sense is probably going to be quite different in different parts of the world.
Well, now, you brought up the question of Arctic methane, and there's still quite a debate among scientists about that. One group calls it an emergency, and other scientists, like David Archer, say Arctic methane is still small compared to our greenhouse gas emissions. Did you have a chance to look into that while you were working on this paper, and what did you find?
I did have a chance to look into that, and there's been some, it is ongoing. I mean, the definitive work on this has not yet been done. However, we can't ignore the gravity of this potential. Right now, the amount of methane that's bubbling up out of the nearshore coastal environments, the subsea permafrost of the eastern Siberian Sea in particular, exceeds all other methane, naturally escaping methane, venting anywhere else in the world. So the quantity coming off of the eastern Siberian shelf of the Arctic Ocean is larger in one, that one spot than anywhere else in the world. That is due entirely to the melting of the subsea permafrost. So that's permafrost. When the ocean levels were low during the last ice ages, that all froze and became permafrost. The ocean rose again and flooded that coastal area, which is a shallow coastal area, right? The permafrost remained in place, okay? But because the Arctic Ocean is warming up, that permafrost that's underneath the ocean in the coastal shelf is melting, and it's starting to release lots of methane. It's got the potential to release 800 billion tons of methane, and if it did, it would be absolutely catastrophic. We would see sudden climate change. So we don't know the extent. We haven't really been able to nail down the extent to which this is a risk, 98% risk, you know, or this is a 5% risk. We know that it's happening. We know that it's destabilizing. If it were to be destabilized at a large scale, it would be catastrophic. So we must pay attention to it. This requires some very serious attention. I think that really from a science standpoint, the final call is still out. It might just bubble away slowly over a long period of time. There's still a lot of information that we need to gather, physically speaking, you know, to be able to project with any real level of confidence the extent to which this is an immediate or perhaps a longer away type of thing. Generally, though, it's going to respond. So there's one of the problems is there's a nonlinear relationship here between the incoming sunlight and the warming of the Arctic Ocean and the Arctic sea ice itself, and the role of all that plays with warming up the water in the eastern Siberian coastal shelf area. However, I can tell you this, that if you take measurements from satellite images of that region, and you easily can quantify that large concentrations of methane in the atmosphere across that coastal region. And then if you also look at the temperature taken from satellites of the region, you see that it's an absolute hot spot, right? That methane, in a localized sense, right, is really playing a role in heating up that region. So there's a series of feedbacks going on, and we're really not sure exactly how that's going to play out, but it is extremely serious, or at least it's potentially very, very serious.
Now, you pointed me towards a pivotal paper by Dr. James Hansen, formerly of NASA. It's titled Assessing Dangerous Climate Change, Required Reduction of Carbon Emissions to Protect Young People, Future Generations, and Nature. And there's two aspects of that that seldom get attention. The first is our obligation to coming generations. Can you talk to us briefly about intergenerational justice?
This question is ultimately one of intergenerational justice. And it really is about our moral obligation to future generations. This isn't just a remote possibility, okay? This is real, and it's here, and it's now. It's no fooling. It's absolutely urgent, Alex, that we change our use of carbon to avoid dangerous and possibly catastrophic consequences. It is profoundly a moral issue. You know, most people, I think, would agree that on some basic values, you know, the idea of a community of peace, liberty, and justice, and the inherent worth of everybody, and respect for this interdependent web of existence, of life, right? I mean, those are very basic kinds of things. And if we think those are important, we have to respond. This is the most serious and most important issue of our time. And we're absolutely absolutely on the threshold of this. The only alternative, Alex, is to sit and watch a very protracted, agonizing decline of civil society. And that's unspeakable, and that's not fair, and it's not morally right to young people and to all those who have yet to be born.
I'll put some links to this work of yours and of Dr. Hansen's and his crew of illustrious scientists that were part of that study in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. As we wrap up here, Dr. Michael Jennings, is there anything you would like to add?
Well, I think we've certainly covered it. It's so difficult to communicate the gravity of the situation and how quickly this is rushing along like a freight train out of control. And we have very, very, from a physical science standpoint, we have very little time in which to pull back from the brink.
Our guest has been Dr. Michael Jennings from the Department of Geography at the University of Idaho. His scientific paper warns humans are heading beyond any safe climate into a period of severe climate disruption. Again, I'll put links at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
It's a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
I clarified one thing with Dr. Jennings. He explained we would hit the ceiling for any safe climate change, if there is any safe climate change, in just 13 years at our current rate of consumption, which is actually going up every year. But Jennings is not saying we will experience the full impacts of climate disruption in 13 years. The good news is the ocean and many other factors will probably buffer and delay the true damage for another few decades. Certainly, rising seas will take several decades at least to really manifest. It takes time for glaciers to melt, for example. That's also the bad news. The true impact could be hidden for humans for several decades, during which time we continue to burn fossil fuels. Then the world changes beyond recognition and possibly beyond our survival. Is it possible we are already entering another dark age? Is that what nature needs to recover? Next in my series of experts on the coming collapse, we enter the long view world of Professor Sing C. Chu. Dr. Chu is a global teacher. He's a professor of sociology at Humboldt State University in California. He's a senior research scientist at Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research in Leipzig, Germany. Dr. Chu has been a visiting professor at universities in Singapore, Hong Kong, Sweden, and Hawaii. As you might imagine, Sing C. Chu is the author of many papers and books. We'll be drawing from just his trilogy on how civilizations rise and fall with their degradation of nature. They are Volume 1, World Ecological Degradation, Accumulation, Urbanization, and Deforestation, 3000 BC to AD 2000. Volume 2, The Recurring Dark Ages, Ecological Stress, Climate Changes, and System Transformation. And Volume 3 in 2008, Ecological Futures, What History Can Teach Us. Yes, Dr. Chu tells us the coming Dark Age is an inevitable cycle of civilization consuming the natural world. That may not be a tragedy. It may mean a rest for the natural world and eventually a rebirth for the human story. I'm Alex Smith, Dr. Sing Chu. A warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Your body of work is so overwhelming, I hesitate to try and compress it into a mere interview, but let's see what we can do together.
Yeah.
You began with your doctorate work on forestry and the impact of deforestation, I believe. Does that continue to play a role in our current situation?
Yes, as you can tell, deforestation has been going on for at least 5,000 years since the start of human civilization. And therefore, it's very important to be aware of that. And also for me, the forest is more like a canary in the coal mine. If the canary passes out in the coal mine, then we have danger. And therefore, the forest, if there have been continuous deforestation, we will also have severe problems, especially when the forest is a carbon sequestration element in the whole reproduction of the whole natural processes.
Now, one thing I found interesting in your writing is that in our prehistory, the challenge was more about global cooling as the ice sheets moved south. And now we're looking at a warming trend, but you say there isn't a great deal of difference as far as our development goes.
Yeah, I tried to discuss that mainly, I believe, it's in Volume 2 of the trilogy, and especially also in Volume 3. And what is really interesting that's going on now is that people are all commenting on climate forcing and the increase in terms of upcoming increase, I would say, of the climate in terms of temperature increases and disturbances. But if you look at the whole history of the climate of the planet, it has been quite chaotic until around, well, I would say, 6,000 years ago before the appearance of the Holocene period. And here the work of, in my book, I refer to the work of Willem Ruderman, where he argues that since the dawn of human civilization, whereby we have the advent of agriculture, especially in the Fertile Crescent, which is now modern southern Iraq, and also in the Huanghou Valley, which is now accepted as one of the earliest civilizations that started. And what that caused is that it started the increase in terms of carbon dioxide and methane. And so on that basis, there's already climate forcing in the early periods of human history. But prior to the 6,000 years, or I would say 8 to 6,000 years ago, the climate has been very chaotic. And it's only during the arrival of the Holocene period whereby there was a climate modulation, and that's the type of weather that we see these days in the sense of chaotic changes. And so the argument is that the humans have, in a sense, like we all have agreed, other than climate deniers, that there has been a real dramatic increase in temperature, and especially within the last 200 years, where you're very familiar with the hockey stick effect, whereby human forcing has been quite dramatic as a consequence of a series of industrial revolutions. So what we are seeing now is a really chaotic period, or upcoming as well. But there had been chaotic periods, but that's before, that's around 6,000 to 8,000 years ago.
Right, before the time of civilization as we know it now.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now, let's move forward a bit. You've really looked at the Dark Ages, and in fact, one of your books is really about that. And there were three previous Dark Ages. Can you tell us about those and why they are really more important in history than we've given them credit.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I, when I was starting to do the research for the three volumes, that I noticed there's a recurring series of chaotic periods in the sense of, if you think in terms of human progress, there's really tremendous stress on the human reproductive capacities of human systems. And actually there are, as we now, in a sense, argue, and as I've argued, that there are really three periods. One that started 2200 BC to 1700 BC, and that was the start of the first Dark Age, as I would call it. And it impacted only on a certain region in the world, because at that 5,000 years ago, at that point in time, there's only very few areas that were populated by humans and in terms of urbanization and all that. And so the three main areas that were really impacted that we have both archaeological information as well as temperature information on is that of the Fertile Crescent, which would be southern Mesopotamia, and then, of course, northwestern India of the Harappan civilization, and then some parts of China. By the 1200 BC period to the 700 BC period, you have tremendous spread, because as the civilizations and society continue to evolve, it's now much more of a global consequences, but not totally global, but mostly between Europe, Central Asia, and South Asia, and China. Then, of course, we have the last one that we are familiar with, which would be the what we normally call the Dark Age of Antiquity. That's when the fall of the Roman Empire started, around about 300 AD to around about 900, whereby you see tremendous consequences. But one of the interesting things that we have to realize about Dark Ages are a series of characteristics that still recur in each Dark Age, right? First of all, as you know, we call it a Dark Age because from our knowledge of progress, you have economic slowdowns and trade disruptions. Then you have political unrest and breakdowns. One of the most interesting features of this Dark Ages is that you have reduced social stratification and social simplification of lifestyles. And I'll elaborate more on this later. Then you have deurbanization, you have increased migration, and you have population losses. All these elements of a socioeconomic and political nature tend to recur over the three Dark Ages. And on that basis, it gives us some ideas of what we can expect if there's a forthcoming Dark Age. The three books, starts to talk about how the implications of this type of trends have for human societies and the reproduction. But what's important that we should realize is that during Dark Ages, whereby it is quite, in terms of progress, retrogressive or devolutionary, but it's a good opportunity because if you have economic slowdowns and trade disruptions, therefore you have a less intensive utilization of natural resources, and the impact on the human, of the environment by humans are going to be less. So on that basis, from the point of nature, it is a really quite a important period because it allows nature to recover because of the slower economic slowdowns. And at the same time, it allows socioeconomic reconfiguration that are allowing for a next stage of social evolution.
We will get back to that. There's a lot more to talk about there. But right now, who do you think has a better chance of riding out a severe economic or ecological challenge, the rich developed world or less developed countries?
Well, it depends. Well, it is actually, if there is going to be a next Dark Age approaching, because of the interconnected nature of the regions of the world, you will definitely find tremendous catastrophic conditions all over the world. Because if you trace the previous three Dark Ages, the places that are interconnected economically, socially, and politically are the ones that are very impacted the most. And to get out of those Dark Age periods, there was economic expansion and political reconfiguration occur in terms of expansion to other parts of the world, whereby there have been less human populations and human development. So what is really interesting that we have to realize is that this is a continuous evolutionary process, and that we are now at a stage whereby there is really tremendous pressure, whereby very few areas of the world have not been, in a sense, inhabited or exploited by human civilizations for their own socioeconomic ends, other than perhaps the ocean. And even in the ocean, the few remaining areas are the Arctic and the Antarctic. And therefore, the question is, where is the next set of expansion going to come from that allows us to continue to use the natural resources that we need to survive? And therefore, when you look at the Dark Ages, then it becomes really interesting. First, during Dark Ages, as I mentioned before, you have reduced social stratification and social simplification of life, lifestyle, not because they would choose to do that, but because they had to do that because of the lack of natural resources. So in certain ways, it forces society to, in a sense, think of new ways to develop new strategies to survive. And in that sense, that's where I believe you have social evolutionary progress.
Now, Dr. Chu, in your last book of your series, Ecological Futures, you don't promise any salvation for this global economy. What do you see happening?
I did try in certain ways because, as you know, the three volumes were written over a course of over a decade, and my attitude towards what's going to happen continues to evolve. But towards the end, I tried to talk about the potential of being able for Earth to evolve, and that evolve further in a sense of a long-term social evolutionary evolution process. What I try to suggest is that we should move to what I call a weightless economy. In other words, whereby we use less natural resources and we use it more intelligent-wise in that context, whereby we're already increasing seeing the potential of that, whereby we purchase what I call symbols that are not materialist, material in nature, and we allow, therefore, a sort of a financial economic exchange to go on forth. In other words, like when, for example, you download a movie or a music video or a song from a website, you're not asking for anything more material from that purchase. You're just paying your monetary funds to get a weightless, or I call it weightless, whereby you're getting a set of images or noise that you see on your iPhone or your desktop or wherever it is. So in that sense, it allows us to continue to be able to meet certain social economic satisfaction without relying too much on the ability of the planet to produce the natural resources for us to continue to meet our, in fact, I think, very exploitative needs.
So cyberspace is the new frontier. I do get that, and people have been talking about that. We'll have to see whether the international internet can survive if we have a global downturn, an extreme one. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with our guest, Dr. Sing C. Chu, an expert in the long-term history and culture of our species. Well, let's take a detour from those heavy thoughts and look at a speech that you gave just at the end of this February in Singapore at the Conference on Sustainability and Education. You ask what university education is for. That's a good question. And then you answer, quote, higher education has largely been shaped by the drive to extend our human domination of the planet. Can we steer it into something different?
You mean like can we change higher education to something different?
Yes.
Yes. What I try to express in the first part of the keynote is that we have different types of knowledge that we do in the university or we produce in the university. There are basically three types. One, the natural scientific knowledge of the natural sciences. And then the other one, the social sciences, which is supposed to provide an understanding of our social world and therefore be able to help us emancipate human societies from some of the issues that it finds challenges to face. Then, of course, the humanities, whereby it's really its interest is in a way to promote the understanding and prolongation of cultural experiences. Now, these three sciences have been, in a sense, played out in the generation of knowledge in the university. And of course, in our day and age, it continues to what I call a very anthropocentric approach, whereby we totally utilize the methodologies, the rationality, and so on and so forth of the natural sciences to determine our lives, both in social choices and in terms of social scientific choices, right? That type of mentality is important in some ways in order for us to have strategic successes into reproducing human societies on a material basis. But we cannot really use that type of knowledge for all aspects of our life. And that's where I suggested in the keynote that we really have to have a balance. We have to consider some of the critical social sciences of providing value judgments about what we should do and what we can do. And as well, the humanities provide certain moral ethos to be able to guide us to let us consider what are the choices in terms of what the past can tell us and what the future can be. I sort of like to think of the past as a teacher of life in certain ways, whereby we let history become a way of guiding us of what has happened in the past in order for us to anticipate a probable livable future.
So what do you mean when you say sustainability is unsustainable?
This is really what we have been talking here in Northern California, in a sense that with the increase in terms of the world's population, with the continuous heightened accumulation of profits and the reinvestment of profits to generate more profits, and with the level of urbanization that is continuously going on, that in some ways, as you know, most urban places are very natural resource intensive and intensive in every other way. So what it means is that there is a continuous, if you want to call it, exponential need to maintain these urban communities. The level of population levels that are increasingly becoming unbearable in terms of the natural environment to sustain. And so why are we talking about sustainability? Because as far as we can really understand it, I'd rather talk about the unsustainability of sustainability, because sustainability has been a concept that has had so many meanings thrown at it, and it started way before the Pearson Commission, where there was that discussion in Canada about that, all the way now to the Brundtland Report, and we have had so many international meetings and organizations coming to address this issue, and so far there has been perhaps ecological awareness, but very little what I would call ecological consciousness, and perhaps in some places there might have been ecological consciousness leading to some social mobilization. But that has not been that successful. And so how are we going to make a sustainable world whereby this conflict over the accumulation of capital determining most of the choices that we make and the urbanization process that are continuously to spiral upwards? And then, of course, you have this deforestation process, which I have, in a sense, talked about in the earlier part of this discussion. But what is interesting about going back to the Dark Ages is that during Dark Ages, you have population losses that forces, therefore, a population drop and, therefore, less intensification utilization of natural resources. Like, I'll give an example. 1 century AD, the city of Rome had 1 million people. After the end of the Roman Empire, with the Dark Age of Antiquity, Rome was around about 40,000 people, right? That population level was never achieved again in Europe until the 18th century London, okay? So you can see these consequences of Dark Ages, whereby it does give us a sense to pause, or it forces us to learn, because I've argued in one of the closing remarks of one of the volumes that it is not the problem of learning. We always learn. Human societies are very ingenious. It is not learning which is the problem.
Well, you know, at the end of each period of civilization, you found institutions which seem to signal the oncoming Dark Age, even as they operate almost as lifeboats for future rebirth later on. Could you describe those for us?
Yeah, there are certain features that you really need to, in a sense, consider that these Dark Ages offer rather than negative moments, but I would call positive moments in terms of the ability of human societies to come up with new solutions, right? If you have a drop in population, for example, there was a drop in population in classical, one of the Dark Ages, and therefore it allows certain rejuvenation in terms of political processes. And in this case, the classical Greece, the period before the classical Greece period, you have the demise and the deurbanization process appearing in Mycenaean Greece. And what happened after that was the evolution and the appearance of the polis, or the first city-state. And that offered opportunity in terms of political development and political learning processes that therefore allow the further evolution of a political process moving away from empires, which still predominated the whole social, political, economic landscape of the Mediterranean. But you have the emergence of this nascent political idea, which then the Romans took it to a different level, to a sort of republican form of political process. And that was really quite interesting, too, because it only lasted a few periods because Republican Rome was then taken by Imperial Rome. So you have this type of opportunities whereby we have the opportunity, or it is forced upon us because of our exploitative nature, to force us to rethink different ways. So right now, we do have opportunities in terms of ideas that we can rethink. I do have a scenario that what happens if there is a total collapse, a global collapse, if you want to call it that way. What will happen? Therefore, it will be utmost upon us to rethink what we are doing, and that maybe perhaps that at that point in time, all the basic knowledge that we have lost in the sense of how to farm and how to live within the landscape, or what we call living along the contours of the land, will really need to be retaught and, in a sense, reinvestigated, and then perhaps a new form of political process or political participation. And, of course, decision-making about our natural environment will force us to make changes.
Well, that's almost the bright side of the Dark Ages. But, you know, if you're a student who are studying to be a success in life now as we know it, that's a tough pill to swallow. What do your students make of this?
Yeah, some of my graduate students have gone on. One of my graduate students, well, I was very impressed that after he finished his degrees, he decided to become a farmer, farm manager for a 100-acre organic farm on the Columbia River. And that was quite a major effect. And I met him a couple of months ago, and he said that he is so invigorated that he wakes up every morning at 4 o'clock because he starts his work, as you know, as a farmer, much earlier than what we normally wake up. And he can't wait to get to work. So there are new opportunities. If we are talking about a weightless economy in the Internet and all that, there are those opportunities there. But the major concern that we have also is that what is going to be provide the sources of energy, right? And therefore, I have read somewhere that the amount of servers that are going to be powered and required to meet this type of Internet age will be about the consumption level of 30% of the world's energy volume per year. So we do have to make choices. And the problem right now is that we really do not make choices. We are guided by our choices, by the urbanization process, by the consumption process, and so on and so forth. We could consider possibly, let's say, a diet or a menu that is here in Northern California. We like to talk about the 500-mile menu or the 50-mile menu. In other words, we do not eat any food materials that are beyond 500 miles. Whereas nowadays, we have a globalized agriculture, we have a globalized food exchange system. Therefore, we are drinking water imported from Fiji. We are buying food from Latin America in terms of farm consumption during certain seasons where we cannot have that. In other words, we can't have it all, and we have to make those decisions. And it's important for us to do that. If not, if my thesis seems to suggest, if not, then nature will make it for us. Or like we've seen here in Northern California, nature is the last one to bend.
Yes, nature can be in the driver's seat if we just take it too far. And it's interesting to think that, as you've talked about, deurbanization, bioregionalism, community-supported agriculture, these are things that are beginning movements now. Maybe those are our preparation for the coming fall. Your program at Helmholtz about shrinking the economy, that's another really interesting story.
Yes, that's a very important issue that we all need to consider.
Yeah.
Yeah, the project has ended, but the shrinkage is something that we really, really have to deal with. It's already ongoing, and there's enough indication that by the United Nations Population Fund that we're anticipating the urbanization to end around about 2070. And that's in some ways dovetail with the, what you call, peak oil issue.
Yeah.
And so all those will have to come to a head. And in other words, I hope that the changes are made consciously by us and not for us.
I agree. And I'm thinking, too, you know, Staples is closing many, many stores because they say everybody's shopping online. So we're starting to take that other direction that you talked about as well.
Yeah, because of the physical space that is not going to be occupied. But then the problem I always talked about is that we have already, in a sense, excavated the whole earth. And so, you know, I wish there was something left, right? So, you know, we didn't talk about terraforming.
No.
And this is now, or else why do you think the International Space Station is being pushed so hard? The Chinese are putting one up, right? And NASA, I think in the 80s, projected that you can have 50,000 two-member families on the moon, right? And that's that big push to go to Mars.
Wow.
And the Mars is where the action is because it's a livable, well, it's not a livable planet without a high-level technology, but it's another way, right? We do hear talk about the issue of, you know, after you wreck one planet, why not try another one?
It's been great talking with you. Perhaps we'll talk again. Yeah.
How did you hear of my work?
I started with Nicole Foss, and then I got to David Korowitz. And I think David Korowitz referenced your work. And then I started looking into it and went, ah, well, this is good stuff.
Yeah, because mostly in Europe, they discover the work because I spent some time in Europe. Well, I mean, I have an appointment in Germany, and that also helps.
Yes, it does. I have to wrap it up there and say Dr. Sing C. Chu, and that's spelled C-H-E-W. He's a professor of sociology at Humboldt State University in California and a senior research scientist at the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research in Leipzig, Germany. And there's things we should talk about there another time. He's introduced nature back into history, and Dr. Chu lectures around the world about past civilizations and dark ages and their message for us now. Dr. Chu, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be able to do this.
I enjoyed it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In this interview and the next, I raise the eerie economic danger of thinking we can burn all those carbon reserves that big companies and fossil fuel-rich countries claim to own on their books. Earlier this year, Mark Campanelli of Carbon Tracker startled world markets with his analysis of the business side of extreme climate change. A couple of weeks ago, Mark gave an hour-long conference on the web organized by the British Columbia Sustainable Energy Association, the BCSEA. Longtime energy man Guy Dauncey was the host. You can watch that full presentation with all the charts on YouTube. Find a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info or at bcsea.org. Campanelli is asking why big oil, gas, and coal companies can raise hundreds of billions of dollars every year on the stock and bond markets without fully disclosing they may not be able to burn those reserves that they claim to own. In other words, they've really overvalued their companies.
Are you pondering what I'm pondering?
I know your objection right away. Of course they will burn it. Governments aren't going to limit fossil fuel use. Here is Mark's answer to just that objection raised during the Q&A.
This conversation is based on the premise that national and international regulations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions will come to pass. So far, they have not been very fruitful. How much faith do you have that serious greenhouse gas reduction measures will be taken, or are you just an analyst?
Yeah, first point to say is that we don't actually have to look at something with the phrase climate regulations. It's coming in many other phrases, in terms of NOx and SOx and air quality directives and so on. But look, there's some scenarios which will happen in the future. Either we're going to have the sort of the happy Goldilocks scenario where everyone sits down and agrees to limit emissions and we'll have a global climate agreement. Something tells me that's not going to happen. The next scenario is that governments and companies and investors will continue as they are now, and we head towards 3 or 4 degrees of warming, where we'll have climate catastrophe, and in that situation, you just won't be able to operate business at all, and investors would have made a bad choice. Or you end up with the last scenario, which I think is the one that will happen, which is people tend to do nothing at all until it's too late, and what will happen is that we continue as business as usual, continue, and then all of a sudden, there will be a significant series of events like Hurricane Sandy's in multiple jurisdictions, places or countries or floods, and governments and society will go, oh no, let's stop. Now, that last scenario is the most damaging of all, where there's a sudden stop to the fossil fuel industry, which will cause a collapse of the economy as well as those companies, and that's what's to be avoided. So what we're looking for is a gradual winding down of the carbon bubble, with regulators stepping in and investors stepping in to get companies to pay back cash before it's too late. So it's unavoidable. If you think that climate, we're heading on a trajectory for rapid climate change, then one of those outcomes will be the outcome that we'll see, either a gentle stop or heading to climate catastrophe, which we absolutely must avoid, or governments leaving it too much too late and then causing huge economic dislocation.
It's partly just our inability to imagine the empire of fossil fuels could fold. Picture the situation in the late 1890s when the first horseless carriages appeared. Everyone knew these were freaks. While horses would continue to be the major vehicle for personal and business transportation, just 3 decades later, cars and horses were duking it out on the roads. By 1950, the last horses in the city were drawing a few milk wagons, and then they were gone. Large changes can and do happen, even if we can hardly believe it now. Mark Campanelli is calling for 2 things. First, fossil fuel companies should be regulated to divulge the full climate risk of what they do, and the probability they cannot capitalize on all the oil, gas, and coal they have in the ground. Second, divestment, selling off investments in these climate-killing companies makes sense, especially for bodies like universities, who claim to represent the future of younger people. But Campanelli, who knows the markets well, suggests simple greed and risk aversion can help these fossil giants wind down, as they must, one way or another. Campanelli says there's no point in spending more billions, actually trillions of dollars over the next years, to discover more reserves that can never be burned. For example, oil companies have to spend more and more to get less and less using expensive processes like the tar sands or deep sea drilling or the Bakken shale. Why not simply return the profits to the shareholders as the companies move away from what will eventually be an unsaleable product? Investors will like that, whether they care about the climate change or not. Sooner or later, the world mega projects for oil, gas, and coal won't be viable. Either they will be limited by public and government demand, perhaps following years of climate-driven weather tragedies, or they will burn on until an economic collapse snatches the funding mechanisms away, again, perhaps due to storms and agricultural collapse so severe society cannot recover. That is the worst-stage scenario. Far better, Campanelli says, for these companies to voluntarily wind down now, giving up new exploration and paying out more to their shareholders this year, not 10 years from now. Behind the scenes, major financial institutions like the HSBC Bank and the Norwegian Investment Fund, that's a giant, and big companies like Shell and BP are starting to recognize the giant lopsided risk that unburnable reserves pose to the overall marketplace. Once shareholders and investors realize the books are cooked, there is a possibility of collapse of the economic system from that one carbon bubble alone. Tune in to this important slideshow by Mark Campanelli of carbontracker.org at the BCSEA website, bcsea.org, or find the link in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. You'll find links there for everything discussed in this program. Please don't forget to donate or subscribe to Radio EcoShock if you can. It helps me keep this show in production and on the air. EcoShock.org. You can contact me anytime using the contact form on the website or email. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland. That was Radio EcoShock. At 10:15, stay tuned for Flashpoints, today taking a look at the role of the National Endowment for Democracy in the Ukraine crisis. And we'll also hear an update on the battle to protect Jeju Island from a massive U.S. military base between the two Koreas. 11 o'clock, we've got the food show coming up. Christopher Leonard, journalist and author of The Meat Racket, will talk about the vertical integration of the poultry industry. And Ivan Rivero talks about edible insects as an ingredient in Mexican cuisine. Thank you, KBOO members, for your great support of this community radio station. If you're not currently a member, you can easily become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. We have a couple of announcements, and then we'll go to Air Cascadia.
Hi, I'm your host for The Union of Time Thieves, a new radio exploration of urban life. This episode, we will take a look at monuments, what they are, how they affect us, and how we can reclaim them. The Union of Time Thieves will be on the fourth Monday of each month from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Last year, the Oregon legislature passed a bill to reduce the size and cost of our state prison system. The bill flatlined prison growth, reduced sentences, and extended transitional leave. The money saved from these reforms was reinvested in Oregon counties for programs and services to help reduce prison intakes, protect the public, and lower recidivism. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear how Washington County plans to spend its justice reinvestment funds. That's Prison Pipeline, March 24th at 6:30 p.m.
Cascadia, today is Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.fm on the web. But we're going to be speaking with Steve Horn today. What's going on in the Crimea is not what you have been told is going on in the Crimea. The outrage expressed by the United States, of course, is misleading. It's never about democracy and human rights. It's always about bringing democracy to people who are a little suspicious of our motives. Can you recall the National Endowment for Democracy? Where have we heard of them before? Does that ring a bell? That's right. Ned, good old Ned, was responsible for the fake coup orchestrated by U.S. spooks in Venezuela. They staged a clumsy attempt to overthrow the government of Hugo Chavez a few years back. Well, turns out, guess where they're operating now? That's right, Ukraine. The objective of the National Endowment for Democracy in most of the countries where it's active in the European region is this. Here's the quote. Helping new democracies to succeed. You can see what huge success they had in Iraq. And for Eastern and Southeastern Europe, they continue, this goal is best met through these countries' accession to the European Union and NATO. And we're going to be speaking today with Steve Horn on exactly that topic. What are the ulterior motives? What other characteristics do Venezuela and Ukraine share? Well, they're a vital interest and concern to multinational oil companies. Just a couple more quick headlines. With NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden's most recent words at South by Southwest and a recent TED Talk, they're still echoing across the political landscape. Wired got together with a few experts and compiled a list of 10 measures that tech companies should adopt to protect customer data. It's all there. 10 very simple measures any tech company could take. Now, if it's out there, and now all we have to do is keep careful watch on those tech companies and see whether they adopt those measures or not. That would be the acid test there. And Joe Wilburton, writing for the New American, points out that regarding oversight of the National Security Agency's warrantless wholesale collection of telephone metadata, and they really are. There's hoovering up everything. No pun intended there. I mean, they're vacuuming up everything. The NSA's warrantless wholesale collection of phone data. We have Representative, and he's a Democrat from Maryland, Dutch Ruppersberger. I just love that name. Shouldn't he be a middleweight prize fighter? In any case, has decided to stick a toe in the constitutional waters. But it's a little more than that. Under a scheme being cooked up by a bipartisan group of congressmen on the House Intelligence Committee, and he is, of course, Rupert Spurger, a ranking member, the individual phone companies would keep the metadata collected from its customers, and the NSA would have to obtain an order from the FISA court. Of course, this is all the same old thing. It's all about appearances. The idea is that their main concern, this congressional panel, their main concern is to provide Americans with something that makes them feel good. They are far more interested in propping up the illusion than actually addressing the problem. Closer to home here in Cascadia, cougars and other large predators are subject to wholesale slaughter recently, like nothing we've ever seen before. And why? Not because they're encroaching on people. People are encroaching on them. More on that, too. Yesterday, Oregon's own Attorney General Ellen Rosenbaum told a federal court that she believes the state's voter-approved ban on same-sex marriages violates the federal constitutional rights of homosexual couples. Rosenbaum added that Oregon is prepared to implement gay marriages if a federal judge strikes down the ban. We have weather, we have all kinds of stuff here, but we also have Steve Horn on the line, and I don't want to miss anything that he has to say on the involvement of Exxon and other of these interests in Ukraine and what's happening in Crimea, because it seems to me that whatever one thinks of Vladimir Putin, and he certainly is, if nothing else, entertaining, I just wish he'd get up there and do the imitation of the crane migrating. That was wonderful. And also, of course, riding horses with no shirt on. A person like Vladimir Putin, in the case